From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about James Howard Williams. He was an Englishman with a deep intuition about animals. He went to Burma in 1920 to work for a British company, and that's where he formed an amazing relationship with the elephants who hauled massive teak logs through the jungle. Williams knew at least 1,000 elephants by name. He knew them by their coloring and their feel and their personalities. But there was one elephant in particular that he established a special bond with. Bandula, a magnificent male. As soon as he first touched the animal, Williams knew his destiny was woven together with Bandula. Today in the program, the writer Vicky Constantine Croke is joining us. She's coming to Utah this weekend. We'll talk about her book, which is a war story, but also a story of love. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a remarkable man and his remarkable relationship with elephants, James Howard Williams. He was known as Billy Williams. Later in life, Elephant Bill. He was an Englishman with a deep intuition about animals. He was profoundly affected by World War I, and he went to Burma in 1920 to work for a British company there. That's where he formed this extraordinary relationship with the elephants who hauled those massive teak logs through the jungle. We are talking with Vicky Constantine Croke today about her book, which tells about James Howard Williams. The book is called Elephant Company, and it includes a harrowing story where the elephants that he had come to know and love, he knew more than 1,000 of them by name, they played a role in World War II. We'll talk about that. But the heart of the book really is the elephants themselves, their courage and their trust. Williams himself always believed that with elephants, the relationship was 9/10 about love. Vicky Constantine Croke is coming to Utah this weekend and will give you details about her visit. She's a writer, a journalist whose work focuses on animals. She's host of NPR member station WBUR's program, The Wildlife. It's a multimedia blog on all things animal. And she's joining us from a studio outside of Boston. Vicky Constantine Croke, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, I guess I wanted to begin with your own interest in animals, which you clearly have. I read somewhere you had a deep affection for The Jungle Book, for example. Where did all of it start? Did you just begin with this deep affection that's hard to explain or pinpoint to a particular moment? I mean, where did it start?
I think it started in the... Well, even before the womb, I think it's genetic. I had a mentor, Roger Karras, who covered animal issues for ABC News for many years. And he always called it a genetic defect that many of us had. But, of course, the more we learn about it, you know, E.O. Wilson has called it biophilia. Mm-hmm. And deep in our past, we had to pay very close attention to the natural world in order to survive. And so there may be an ingrained interest we have. Something I found very interesting recently is there is some half funny and half real theory that part of the reason that modern man survived over Neanderthals is because modern man had dogs in our camps. Mm-hmm. And Neanderthals didn't. But I think that there's something just very, very basic and primitive in many of us, a love for animals. But even as a kid, definitely thought there was even a divine connection. And I remember the Bible story of Daniel in the lion's den, which seemed to me to say that if you're truly good, you have this reverence for and connection to animals, and could save your life.
Because it was about empathy. I mean, if you show them love and not fear and not hostility, that you can somehow work something out.
That's right. That's right. And it's respect. It's obviously respect, too. It's understanding that animals don't always want us near them and being able to respect that. But somehow that is my It feels very divine to me. It feels otherworldly and almost like a miracle when I make a connection or when I learn about and read about someone's deep, deep connection with another species.
There's this story. We'll come back to this. Obviously, I want to sort of work us through it, but maybe it's too early to talk about. But there's this moment you tell of James Howard Williams early on, how there was an employee or something. You don't tell too much about the story, but that, at least early on in the book, about someone had tried to kill him,
yes,
who worked for him. And the thing that he came to realize, and he learned this in terms of because of the way he saw the interaction of the elephants and the level of respect. And he came to realize that if he had treated this man with dignity and respect, the same kind of dignity and respect he was seeing with the elephants, that it wouldn't have gotten to that point of hostility.
That's right. Over and over again, he observed elephants, and in them, he said they made him a better man. They taught him about trust and courage, about humor and fairness. Mm. And that was one of the many lessons that he learned. He had a camp worker working for him who was not trusted by the company, but Elephant Bill decided to give this man a chance, and he disappointed him.
Yeah.
He took off with money that was given to him, and he didn't return with the supplies that he was supposed to bring back. And he was very late. Weeks later, he came back to camp. But Williams dealt with him in the most disrespectful way. He kept working. He only looked up slightly, and then he told the man to leave the tent. And he didn't say, just leave the tent. He said it almost in using bad language in Burmese, the most disrespectful way of telling him to just kind of clear out of the tent. And the man became enraged and ended up pulling a knife on Williams. One of the most beautiful things, I think, that Williams understood all fellow creatures, including human beings, is that the man ended up stabbing him. And Williams, after the fact, said he had been complicit in his own attempted murder,
yeah,
that he had treated this man so disrespectfully that, of course, that's the way he reacted. And he said a very simple thing, and that is that he said if he treated the camp worker with as much respect as he treated his elephants, it never would have happened.
You've talked about wanting to, early on in your life, you were thinking, gosh, it would be nice to live a life like Jane Goodall, for example. Did you really mean it? I mean, did you think of kind of a solitary life in the jungle following one species of animal? I mean, was that how you kind of envisioned your life for a time?
Absolutely. I thought for sure. And, you know, especially at that time when I was growing up, there were very few women who lived the life of an adventurer. Yeah. And Jane Goodall, I know, stands as a hero to young girls of many generations, actually. And at that time, I began when I was about 12, I think, In the Shadow of Man came out, a book that Jane Goodall wrote. And Jane is the person who's been studying chimpanzees, obviously, for 40-plus years. But she went to the forest in Tanzania when she was a very young woman. There were no instructions on how to do it, and she made a life for herself. And she wrote about it, and she wrote a children's book also, or a book for young readers. And my love for animals, and I had always wanted to go to Africa, and I thought, this is the way I would like to live my life. And unfortunately, I was diagnosed the next year with lupus.
Yeah.
And so I was my doctors told me I would never get to go to Africa, and I should put that out of my mind. I ended up deciding to become a writer. I also ended up being very healthy after all of that happened. And I did get the chance to go to Africa. I do think that my own life came full circle and went to where it should be, and that is that I did get to go to Africa, and I write about the animals there. I'm not sure I had the fortitude to be like Jane Goodall, but I really admire her, and she changed my life just reading about her, and certainly I've met her many times since then.
There are a lot of parallel impulses, it seems to me, between Jane Goodall and James Howard Williams. One was this desire to live a solitary life. One was this intuitive connection with animals. Another one, though, is that the insights that they learned about these animals that wouldn't be scientifically accepted for decades and decades, but they both saw something in Williams' case, in elephants, using tools, having reactions to death and emotions that were far more complicated than science thought. I mean, the same thing with Jane Goodall and chimpanzees.
That's a perfect parallel, Doug. And the funny thing is that part of the insight that Williams had and Jane Goodall involved tool use, something that we used to think of as being the exclusive domain of man. And I'm not going to be able to paraphrase it very well, but Jane Goodall's big discovery in the early 60s is when she saw chimps using tools to fish at a termite mound. And she told Louis Leakey, her mentor, about it. And he said something like, he sent a telegram saying something like, we'll either have to change the definition of tool of chimpanzee or of man, something like that. Okay. And Williams, so now decades before that, we're talking, he went there in 1920. And he understood that when elephants took a branch from a tree and then modified it to reach an itch on their backs, to scratch their own backs, that was tool use. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know at the time that using the term tool in terms of what an elephant is using was an amazing kind of breakthrough fact. He just saw them using tools and he said so. I mean, one of the great cases of that is that in Burma, the mahouts, or elephant handlers, are called uzis. Mm-hmm. And the uzis, each uzi had his own elephant that he worked during the day. And the uzi, each uzi would carve a teak bell for his elephant to wear around his or her neck. And the sound of that bell was unique because the bell was made by that uzi. So when they went to look for their elephants, they could tell by the sound of the bell which tone was their own elephant as they went through the thick forest. And another bit of tool using and ingenuity on the part of the elephants was that the elephants got rounded up in the morning. They were released into the forest at night. They would be rounded up in the morning. Their bells would give them away. That was fine with them. But occasionally when they had gotten onto something really good, you know, they'd gotten into a rice paddy and were chowing down and they didn't want their handlers to find them, they would stuff mud up inside their bells to silence them.
Which reveals something which we'll come back to, actually. That is a kind of sense of humor almost.
That's right.
It's kind of a lovely image. I have to say you mentioned the elephants scratching their backs with the stick. And the way you write about it is, you know, they would find a big stick. And if it wasn't long enough, they would ditch it, you know, and find one that was. I mean, they were kind of searching out the right size for it, which gives them a sense of a real personality. And I have to say that is one thing that the book absolutely conveys. And that seemed important to James Howard Williams.
He saw them as individuals. And I have to tell you that one of the I considered it a compliment. In the first draft of the book, my editors were concerned that the elephants were better drawn than the people, their personalities.
Right.
And I thought that was a good thing. But elephants are big-brained animals, and they have to negotiate a very complex social world. So they're smart. And the sense of their intellect, Williams got onto very early. And I think that was what makes people, for me, real heroes. And I think that if you are open to understanding another creature, I think that you're open to understanding your fellow human beings in a way that others in your culture might not be. There's a kind of acceptance that I see both in J.H. Williams, Billy Williams, and in Goodall and people like that. And they're just open to observation, a kind of openness that I really envy in all ways.
Billy Williams grows up on the coast of Cornwall, middle of three brothers, and they all liked to wander around in the wilderness. But there's this terrific story that you tell in the book of how Williams would envision where a wren's nest would be and find it. Would you tell that story? Because it reveals this kind of extraordinary intuition that he had about animals.
It's thank you for that, Doug, because I think that is really important. It isn't that Williams was necessarily a wren expert. He was a creature expert, and that is that he would observe the animals around him wherever he was. And it did translate from Cornwall to Burma. And when he was a kid, he observed wrens. He understood them to the extent, and he does this once at least once in his life where he can almost imagine, he puts himself in the mind of Bandula, the elephant, and he can track him in a way that doesn't even involve footprints. And in that way, in Cornwall, he would observe the wrens. He understood where the conditions under which they like to build a nest and where they like to build a nest. And he put himself in the mind of a wren, and he could just scoop his hand down into the vegetation where he thought a nest would be, and invariably his hand would touch a nest with eggs in it. And he just was that kind of – we use the word intuition. It may be deep observation, but he could climb into the mind of other creatures and see the world through their eyes. I think that's a phenomenal gift.
Here's how you put it in the book. You said he developed this knack for – framing the world as an animal did. So he had to change his perspective almost. And if he framed it that way, then that gave him the insight, I guess.
That's right. That's right. And all the people who were around him always described him in that same way of being able to do it with his fellow human beings. He understood other people's point of view.
He fought with distinction in World War I, lucky enough to get out of that as, you know, millions died, obviously, fought in the deserts of Egypt and not only North Africa, but the Middle East and India and Afghanistan. But you say in the book that Williams never would write or speak of his experiences in the war, that he had this tendency to kind of lock away his deepest emotions. What was
That's right.
Do you think?
I think in some ways we think of that almost as a British stereotype, the stiff upper lip.
Sure.
Yeah, he certainly had that. But there was also just part of him, I think it's part of his time, it's part of his own personality, that he didn't talk about the things that made him sad or depressed him. He talked about the happy times, and it certainly doesn't mean he didn't register sadness or depression, because he did. He saw terrible fighting in World War I and several battlefronts in Afghanistan, in North Africa. But he didn't write about those things. And interestingly, in interviewing his family members, he didn't speak about them either. It was very rare for him to talk about World War I. So when he came home from the wars, he was still very young. He was 23 years old. But he was a captain in the army. He had seen horrible fighting. He had seen death. And he knew he wanted to go someplace and have an adventure, and he knew it would involve animals. And interestingly, an army buddy of his told him that a company, a Scottish company, was hiring in Burma. And it was the Bombay Burma Trading Corporation. And what really got to Williams is that he was told he'd be able to work with elephants. So he applied immediately. And when he got home, his parents were very upset. He had survived World War I, had come home to them whole. I mean, they were seeing soldiers returning to England with missing limbs and their faces half blown off, or with shell shock. They had damage internally. Mm-hmm. And here their son comes back alive, whole, happy, and he wants to go away again to a part of the world that was considered the other side of the moon. It was one of the most exotic locations in the world, and they really tried to talk him out of it. But he was determined. He was determined to go, and it was the elephants who drew him there.
That's a great story, too. I mean, his father is desperate for at least one of the brothers to, you know, run the farm. It was a very successful operation. Would you tell that story of where he says, go down and take a swim and then come back and tell me your decision? Because I really love that little moment.
That's great. He Billy Williams grew up in Cornwall, and he grew up on the coast. From his bedroom, it's not even an exaggeration to say that he could see or hear the lights from seven lighthouses. So he almost was a marine creature himself. And his father knew his other brothers were not going to stay home, and Billy was his last hope. Told his father that he wanted to go to Burma. He had his mind made up, and his father said, do me a favor. Before you make up your mind, go down to Panamal Cove, jump into the ocean, have a swim, and come back to me when you've thought about it. It's almost like returning him to the salt water, to the elements will bring him to his senses. And so Williams trots down to the cove. He goes for a bracing swim in the cold ocean water, and he comes out just, you know, gritty with the sea salt. And he tells his father his mind is made up. Right. He's headed for Burma.
He fell in love with the idea right off the bat as soon as his buddy had told him about it. And you say at this part of the book that he was looking in some ways for a new identity. Do you know what that identity was? What did he have in mind, if he had anything in mind about that?
I think, you know, he was a very, you could either say he was often accused of being superstitious, but I see it as he was a very spiritual guy. And I think that he knew he was heading for his destiny. Somehow he felt that, and he didn't quite know what it was. He had heard the term elephant walla. He really did not know what an elephant walla was, an expert in elephants in the Far East. But he was determined to find out, and so he went off to Burma. He came under the guidance of one of the toughest, roughest, most harsh bosses there existed in the teak company, who ultimately Williams decides that his boss had been that way to him as a kindness. Williams comes to Burma, and he is one of 41 recruits who were hired in 1920. 7 years later, there will only be seven of them remaining. The rest are either dead or they're disillusioned. They've run from the forest screaming. It takes a particular kind of man from the West to come into these forests and make his way and thrive. And so he comes there. And he meets his boss out in the forest. And his boss is determined to find out if Williams has the right stuff or not before he sends him alone and into the forest. And he wants to break him. He goes through a severe hazing because if Williams doesn't have what it takes, the boss wants to send him home before any more damage is done. And but very quickly, Williams realizes, feels in his bones that this is the place for him. And I think it's so sweet that he had been in World War I. He did not talk about the kind of horrors that he had experienced there. He didn't talk about needing to be cured. And yet on his very first trip through the forest on his own, but with his little caravan of elephants and workers, camp workers, he realizes he feels a thrill in the spotted sunlight, in the checkered sunlight of the forest, and hearing the bells of the elephants following behind him, that he experiences a kind of thrill he thought was over for him.
Yeah.
And I just think it's this lovely, lovely moment in which he realizes he is literally and metaphorically on the right path.
There's this interesting thing he does early on that begins to win over this crusty old boss of his. Willie Harding is the name that he gives him. All of those stories are great with Willie Harding, by the way. But he goes out and he's assigned, I think he's assigned four elephants at first.
That's right.
And one of them, a female, very old, Pinwa is her name. She dies overnight. And you say in the book that Williams sees this as an opportunity to really learn. I mean, he had read all the textbooks, you say.
Yes.
But now he figured here was an opportunity to really see how they work. And so he cuts her open. He does this kind of autopsy on this elephant. And he spends a day doing this. I mean, in the gore of this animal. Would you talk about this moment? Because it's remarkable.
It is remarkable. You know, Williams had the two big textbooks of the time about elephants. Of course, they were quite limited. I mean, the cures that were listed in those books included, a poultice of roasted onions to treat boils, or brandy if an elephant's stomach was upset, or allspice for flatulence. So he knew he had a lot to learn that he couldn't even read in the standard textbooks of the time. And when the oldest elephant in his group of four, this is Williams' first trip into the forest on his own, and he sent out, not knowing a word of Burmese, but told not to return to camp until he speaks Burmese.
Right.
And he goes out with these four elephants, and he begins to study them, and he grows very close to each of them. These are... in fact, so he sees them during the day when he's working with them, and then when they're released into the forest at night, he follows them, and he grows very close to them and feels an incredible affection for these four elephants. And I think the way that he worded it in his journals and diaries was that the day that Pinwa, the old female, the old dignified female with her wrinkly skin and her ears folded down with age and her rheumy eyes, when the men came to say that Pinwa died, he said tragedy struck. But at the same moment, he realized that this was an opportunity and that he wouldn't really understand elephants. He wanted to understand them inside out, literally. So he cuts her open. There's an interesting I think it's a BBC program that you can get on YouTube where there is a necropsy, and that is an animal autopsy given to a zoo elephant. And just watching that, I could understand what incredible work it was for Williams to cut a dead elephant open and explore her insides, which basically they're so huge that it made shade over his head. But using what implements he had, what knives he had, he pulled out her organs one by one and laid them out so he would be familiar with what they looked like, what they felt like, their size. None of this was listed in the textbooks that he read. And he knew that later in his working career, if he stayed on, that education that he gave himself that day would help him understand deaths of many more elephants.
When we get back from a break, we'll talk about the fairest tusker of them all, Bandula. We're talking with Vicky Constantine Croak about her book, Elephant Company, the inspiring story of an unlikely hero and the animals who helped him save lives in World War II. She's coming to Utah this weekend, going to be speaking Saturday night at 7:30. The Intermountain Therapy Animals is hosting her at the Fort Douglas Officers Club. That's on the campus of the University of Utah. We'll give you details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Vicky Constantine Croak is joining us. She's coming to Utah this weekend. We'll give you the details about that. We're talking about her book. It's called Elephant Company. It's the story of Elephant Bill Williams, an Englishman who was a gifted trainer and champion of elephants in Burma. His work made headlines, though, when the Japanese invaded. This was during World War II. His Elephant Company managed a daring escape over treacherous mountain terrain. That's in this book, of course, as well as remarkable stories about Elephant Bill and his relationship with these elephants. Well, let's talk about the most important of these creatures for him. This was Bandula. Let's talk about when he first meets this elephant, because at first you say he's obviously magnificent when he first encountered him. And at first his eyes seemed vicious, but then he looks closer and he sees something else. And he sees something that is kind of knowing, I think is how you put it in the book, and intelligent.
He sees, he had heard, his men told him about Bandula before he ever got to that camp. And he thought that they were exaggerating, that no elephant could be this magnificent, this beloved by everyone in the forest. And as he says later, every forest officer, every English forest officer working for the company would claim to have worked with the magnificent Bandula. So he knew he'd be beautiful. I mean, Bandula would be one of the largest logging elephants working in Burma at the time. But when Williams is brought to camp, he can see Bandula right away, because there is this elephant who is perfectly shaped for logging, who has pink freckling across his trunk and ears, and his tusks go out. The people who worked among the elephants had names and categories for body types and for tusk sets. And Bandula's tusk sets, his tusks went up and out like the arms of a Burmese dancing girl. So he was a beautiful elephant, big, magnificent. But there was something more to him. And Williams walks up to him, and in his eyes, he sees a soul. He sees a connection, an intellect. And then Williams touches Bandula, as by this point, it's very early in his career. It's the first few months that he's been out meeting elephants. He's gotten comfortable with putting his hands on elephants and having close contact with them. But he touches Bandula, and he experiences something that didn't happen with any of the other elephants. And that is that he felt an immediate spiritual connection. And he felt this was a creature who knew or would know him better than any fellow human being ever would. And in many ways, they were kind of twins. They were born in the same month and year in November of 1897. So they were, and they had so many things in common. When I think of them, I think of them as brothers. And I think that Williams did too. They were both physically very hardy. They were creatures that you could depend on. They were funny and smart. They were both beloved by everyone around them. They were unique. as compared to their own species. And they were blazing their own path. There was nothing as great a worker as Bandula was in the logging camps. He was never submissive. He was always a thinking elephant. And his personality shined through to everybody. He worked in many ways, they felt, because he was willing to. Yeah. If he didn't want to do something, he didn't. And one of the great stories about Bandula is that he was famous for – he could move huge logs that other elephants couldn't move. And what the elephants in the logging camps did is that they would bring teak trunks to creeks or rivers, and those waterways would bring the lumber down to mills in the city. So the elephant's job was to get them the logs from the forest to waterways, and that was the main thing that they did. So Bandula would bring a giant log, he'd bring it all the way through the forest, up and down a hill, he'd get it to the creek, and just before it fell into the creek, he would pretend, Bandula the elephant would pretend he couldn't move the log another inch. And his rider always knew what he was up to and say, Bandula, come on, come on, I know you can do this. Don't fool around. Just move the log and we have a lot of work to do. And Bandula would mime this huge effort. He'd put his shoulder into it and act like it just wouldn't go anywhere. And then finally, after more begging from the rider, he would flick it into the river with no effort at all. And what everyone who worked with Bandula would swear is that Bandula would laugh at his own joke.
Right. This amazing roar that was approaching laughter. I loved that story. And the sense of humor in a lot of elephants, you tell stories of similar mischievousness. Would you read, though, this section where he first touches Bandula? Because I do love this this moment here.
I would love to. Williams reached out to pat Bandula's trunk and felt a very odd sensation, a meeting of souls. He was certain that a current of mutual recognition had passed between him and this elephant. Quote, it was not merely that chance or fortune brought me together with him, he would write years later. It was destiny. Rubbing the high-up portion of the tusker's trunk, he sensed an unbreakable bond being formed. In that instant, Williams had, quote, a feeling of understanding him as a fellow creature closer than many human beings. That thought fit Billy Williams's ideology. A superstitious man, he jingled the coins in his pocket at the sight of the new moon for financial luck and was adamant that peacock feathers with their circular evil eye patterns did not belong inside the house. He was spiritual, too, for he felt moved by forces that weren't necessarily visible or easily explainable. Coming to Burma had only amplified those leanings. Quote, there are ways of knowing things quite certainly, but not by reason, he would write. And in the East, both the wise and the simple accept this. The moment with Bandula seemed transcendent, and yet there were earthly reasons, too, for him to feel so drawn to the tusker. They were classmates in a way, born in the same month and year, November 1897. At the time of their meeting, they had both just turned 23 and were beginning their adult lives in the jungle.
There's this moment you tell in the book, really dramatic moment, when Williams is desperately ill. He gets sick all the time. It seems like he got malaria every year. But in this particular moment, he is really ill. And Bandula is transporting him to hospital to get help. And you talk about how Bandula knows something is wrong with him. And you say that Bandula could smell something was wrong with Elephant Bill. This is how you describe it in the book. Bandula was picking up organic clues. And I wanted you to explain that, if you would, because you say elephants are master chemists. They analyze the world through their nose.
That's right. We're at the very beginning of understanding how much they take in through their trunks. I mean, it's estimated that they're something like 5 to 20 times their sense of smell is better than a bloodhound, and the army is actually trying to understand an elephant's sense of smell for detecting bombs, believe it or not. There's a lot that elephants can do that we as human beings cannot do, even with our most sophisticated equipment. And we know that elephants can detect in a female's urine whether she's receptive for mating or not. And that's something our scientists still can't do with a urine analysis of a female trying to see if she's in estrus or not. So we know that elephants read the world very exquisitely through their trunks and their sense of smell. And if you've ever been around an elephant, the way that they greet you is with their trunk, and they're quite bold and they have no embarrassment about putting their trunk all over you to determine everything about you. And so Bandula read human beings. He'd been around enough human beings, and he read them in the same way that he read his fellow elephants. He knew everything about Williams. When Williams first came there, he smelled different. As Williams became an experienced jungle man, his chemical scent changed, his diet changed, his smoking habits changed, his fat-to-muscle ratio changed. And on this day that Williams was so ill, and he was accustomed to having malaria, he said that the men in the jungle just treated it like a cold. They knew that they would have malarial attacks a few times a year, and they knew what to do to deal with them. But sometimes many other tropical diseases would attack them at the same moment. And in the story that you're talking about, Williams was sicker than he ever had been or ever would be in the jungle. We know that he had malaria. He was suffering from a fungus that made all of his lymph glands swell up to the size of baseballs. And he couldn't eat. He couldn't stand. He was near death. And there was only one way out of this forest. It was during monsoon season when it's impossible to travel. The mud is as high as an elephant's hip. So you can imagine moving 50 or 100 miles is nearly impossible through the forest. But they take Bandula. Bandula is a logging elephant. He's not what they call a traveler. The travelers are the elephants who move the equipment around for people like Williams. The logging elephants do the very hard work and wear the harnesses for logging. So this was an unusual assignment for Bandula to act as a traveler, and that is he's assigned to bringing Williams, the nearly unconscious Williams, through the forest and then to cross a raging monsoon river with no less, as if that weren't dangerous enough. But the logs that they have stockpiled in the creeks and rivers under monsoon conditions are now moving at speed down these torrential, rampaging rivers. And they're 2-ton logs. When they're hitting each other, it's a sound like thunder. And Bandula is going to be asked to cross one of those rivers with Williams on his back. But Bandula does what all elephants do. He investigates Williams through his trunk, and he can smell the infection. He can smell the sickness. He can smell that Williams is not as clean as he usually is. And Williams felt that in that moment, Bandula understood what was being asked of him. Bandula understood how sick Williams was, and he knew he was bringing very fragile cargo for a very long distance. And Williams felt grateful. And he felt optimistic that he would make it to a doctor because he was on Bandula's back.
There's a great story that you tell about Po Toke, who cares all his life, mostly anyway, for Bandula. And the way Po Toke and then eventually Williams tries to reform the way these elephants are captured and trained, the way they've traditionally been trained. I think it's called kedaring. Is that
that's right?
How it's pronounced?
That's right.
Kind of barbaric, and really cruel. And William sees it, as does Po Toke, and wants to change it. Would you talk about that part of the story?
I think this is one of the most. Sometimes I feel that people know they're living their destiny, and here is a case where a young man from England, bumps into a master mahout in the jungles of Burma, and they both have one thing on their mind, and that is to change the way that elephants are brought into service for the teak logging company. Williams one day saw these very ropey scars on the ankle of one of the elephants and asked the men where they came from, and he was told about kedaring, and he would see kedaring later. It was traditional for thousands of years. You go out and capture elephants by driving them into a stockade and then beating them mercilessly, withholding food, withholding water, sometimes burning them, shouting at them until they're so broken, not just physically but, as William said, heartbroken. And we know this from Daphne Sheldrick, who saves African baby elephants in Kenya, and they can die of heartbreak. So we know that this is true. We know all these decades later, all these things that Williams told us was absolutely right. So he saw that elephants could be so heartbroken. And he already has in his mind that he wants to persuade the company to not acquire elephants this way anymore. And he meets Po Toke. And Po Toke is 15 years older than he is. He's not only worked with elephants, he has Bandula. And he trained Bandula from the time he was young. Now, at that time, the female elephants who had babies would continue working. They weren't allowed to take the time to feed their elephants and to care for them the way they should. And so they had this something like a 70% mortality rate among those calves. And Williams meets Potok. Potok took Bandula as a young calf and began to train him. Bandula learned all the basic commands from his mother. He was like a mini-me. When his mother was told to sit, which is smit, he would sit when she sat. And then ta is stand up. And when she was told ta, he would rise when his mother rose up. So he already understood these things. And Potok gets this idea, let's gentle elephants. Let's not break them. And Potok is a Burmese working guy. There's no way the company is going to listen to him. Along comes Billy Williams, who knows that he wants to do this but doesn't know how to, and now he meets the man who's telling him how to do it. So the two scheme together that they're going to change the way elephants are taught and trained and the way that they live within the company. And the way that Williams has to do this is not by saying, look, you guys are being too mean to the elephants, and that's not right. They're feeling beings. He has to prove to them that it makes economic sense.
Right.
And so he draws up the paperwork to show them that it makes financial sense for the company instead of letting all these babies die if you raise them, and then they become more reliable working elephants for you.
Before we head to a break, I wanted to mention the story of Ma Cha, Miss Smooth. You talk about heartbreak, and it comes up a few times, actually, the idea where an elephant is heartbroken. But there are a lot of these stories of loyalty and bravery, and this is one of them that's really lovely about Ma Cha's calf and their relationship. It's amazing. Would you tell that story?
Yeah, so this elephant, Mahuni, and the English translation is fire opal because she had beautiful eyes. But by the time that Williams had persuaded the company to allow him to train elephants in a more gentle way, he was allowed to open elephant school. And during the weeks that all the elephants, female elephants who had five-year-old calves were to report to school, and this elephant came through the forest with her five-year-old calf. And the calves, by the way, at that age had not been named yet. The tradition was that you waited till they were about 5 years old, and you could see the elephant's real character, and that's when you would come up with the appropriate name. So this calf and his mother travel a long distance to come to elephant school, and when they arrive, Fire Opal has gone blind, the mother elephant. There are plants in the forest that do many things, and one of them is the very fluid material inside the stems of a certain plant can make you go blind if it touches your eyes. And so she has gone blind, and she arrives at school, and Williams says, well, what am I going to do? Here's a working elephant, a logging elephant who can't see. I don't know what to do with her. One of the sweet things is that he asks all the elephant men, what should I do about this? And they all say, have mercy. Have mercy. I love it. That was their response. And he said, well, I am going to have mercy, but I don't know what to do about her life, where she'll stay. And at that moment, he realizes that the little calf, who's 5 years old, and as he says, they're kind of bratty at that age. They want a little bit of independence, and they're not listening. And he realizes that the blind elephant rests her trunk along the back of her little five-year-old calf, and he's leading her where she needs to go. And, of course, not only do they allow the calf and the mother to stay together, but that leads to the perfect name for her little calf, who becomes Guide Man or Little Guide Man.
There's this heartbreaking moment where Guide Man dies. And it doesn't take long for Mahuni to die either. Did she die of a broken heart?
I'm certain that she did. And, you know, we keep saying, Doug, you brought up Jane Goodall, and it keeps reminding me of so many things. Jane Goodall, there's a very famous chimp that she studied, old Flo. When Flo died, her son died not long after. I'm certain that animals can die of heartbreak, social animals. And, yes, it's one of the scenes in the book. I cried and cried writing it. I cried every time I've edited or read it. Because that story really, really gets to me. They developed such an exquisitely close relationship, as you can imagine. They were never far from each other, and she depended so heavily on her son that they knew each other almost as kindred spirits rather than mother and son. And because elephants can use infrasound and hear infrasound, I feel certain that a communication had gone on between them. She understood that he was drowning. She understood that he drowned and stood over the place where he was. And she cried and cried and wouldn't eat after that and died not long after. I'm certain that she understood what became of him and that she didn't want to live.
Yeah. Vicky Constantine Croke is with us. We're talking about her book, Elephant Company, the inspiring story of an unlikely hero and the animals who helped him save lives in World War II. That World War II part we'll talk about when we get back from a break. I should mention that Vicky Croke is going to be in Utah's guest of the Intermountain Therapy Animals Group. She's giving a talk at 7:30 at the University of Utah's Fort Douglas Officers Club on Saturday. The event is free, and you can get details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Vicky Constantine Croke. We're talking about her book, Elephant Company. She's coming to Utah on Saturday here as a guest of Intermountain Therapy Animals, giving a talk on the campus of the University of Utah. We'll give you the details about that on our website and a little bit later on the program. Well, a critical part of the story, which we haven't talked about yet, I didn't want to give too much away, is the role that the elephants and Elephant Bill play in World War II. But I do want to talk about one of the crucial moments here. Maybe set this up for us first, if you would. This Burma had become this critical kind of strategic place because the Allies were trying to keep the Japanese from getting a path to India. And so they enlist Billy Williams.
That's right. And Williams knew the western part of Burma like the back of his hand. He was a walking map. And so initially they brought him into the War Office to provide as much information as he could about rivers and mountains. And this is a country with no infrastructure whatsoever. And so for troop movement, they needed to know where things were and for him to be this a map on his own to tell him. But he knew that the real work that he could do for the Allied forces would be in working with his elephants. And it wasn't as supply animals as the Japanese used the elephants in Burma to carry supplies. But he knew they could do much more than that. And that is, he understood all the time that he was in the forest, if they needed to bridge a creek or even a small river, they would make these very homespun, simple elephant bridges that just pull down some of the logs alongside the waterway. And the elephants acted as cranes and could place them over the water and put them, place each log next to each other to build a very solid bridge. And so it took Williams a while to persuade his superiors that this is what the elephants could do. Initially, they send him back. Burma was completely taken over by the Japanese. Mm-hmm. He was allowed back in the country, and he had to be a part of Force 136, and that's the British Dirty Tricks Department, because he would be working behind enemy lines since they had taken over the whole country. So he went back in. He gathered up a few of the irregulars, men like Williams himself, who had worked their whole adult lives in the forests of Burma, knew the language, knew the people, knew the terrain, knew the weather, and most of all knew elephants. And he set about trying to gather elephants who by now, the British had completely left Burma. So his elephant riders were hiding in their own villages and in the jungles. And he had to get word to them that he wanted them to come back to him and where he was and bring their elephants to him so they could start working. What's interesting is that at that time, the view of the Japanese soldier was that they were impervious to jungle horrors, that they could work under any conditions and that they were superior to the Allied forces. But Williams knew that the native Burmese, the people he had worked with all his life, knew the jungles better than anybody else. Right. And in fact, he was right. He got word out to them, and they could sneak through the jungles right under the nose of the Japanese to bring their elephants, not to the Allied forces. They didn't necessarily have a political agenda, but that they were very loyal to Williams himself. He had always been good to them his whole life, as you can imagine, and they felt a loyalty to him. So he set about starting what would become Elephant Company. His first elephant recruited was, of course, Bandula.
Right.
And that gave him a kind of confidence in what he was doing. Just to be next to Bandula gave him confidence. And by the war's end, he would have more than 1,600 elephants in Elephant Company, and they would be carrying supplies, but most of all building those bridges. And by war's end, there would be 270 elephant-built bridges. And not only did they help in that kind of world without infrastructure inside the country, but there was a new kind of portable bridging material called Bailey bridges. And because the elephants built so many smaller bridges, they could save the Bailey bridging for the really important jobs. And one of them that went across the Chindwin River in 1944 is considered a very big moment that bridge could be built. So the elephants really made a significant contribution to victory for the Allied forces in Burma.
There's a moment we don't have a lot of time to talk about or really read, but and I don't want to give too much away about this moment, but they come upon this sheer cliff face, and they have to be enterprising to deal with it, and they somehow manage to create this kind of elephant staircase, and Bandula has to take the first step, and there's this amazing moment where he places his first two front feet on that first step, as you point out. And then he stays motionless for, as you say in the book, a minute, and then two, and then three. And for 9 minutes, he just sort of stands there deciding whether he's going to go up. And everyone's just wondering, because if he doesn't go, they're trapped. Right. Will you say something finally about that moment? Because it's extraordinary.
I think that moment, for Williams, this was the validation of his entire life's work. And it says everything about him as a person. It says everything about elephants as a species and Bandula as an individual, as a thinking animal. They're fleeing the Japanese. The Japanese are all around them. They can hear the mortar fire. And they have to move into India, and they're faced with this cliff. Bandula is being asked to walk up a ladder, kind of a stone ladder, something he's never done. They've been asked to walk over logs, so he knows that command. But in Bandula's hesitation and then decision to go forward, and I do like the fact that you used the word deciding, he decided to go forward, Williams believed that Bandula took in the task before him. He waited. He fully understood what was to happen, what he was going to be asked to do, what he was being asked to do. And so he stands on that first step, and he's thinking, and he decides to go forward. And once he goes forward and starts climbing, he does not stop. And all the elephants and all the people, and there are 64 refugees being saved, all follow behind him.
Vicky Constantine Croak, her book is called Elephant Company. She's going to be in Salt Lake City on Saturday for the Intermountain Therapy Animals Group. She's going to be giving a talk on the campus of the University of Utah at 7:30. We'll give you details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Vicky Croak, thank you very much for the time.
Lovely to talk to you, Doug. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.